Well, I'm sure most of you have heard the name of Caiaphas before. Have you heard about Caiaphas? Who is that guy, by the way? Okay, well, I won't put you on the spot. He's the high priest at the time where Jesus is crucified. And as the high priest, he is supposed to be kind of like the number one leader in almost everything. So he's almost like the Pope, the President, the Chief Supreme Court Justice, all kind of rolled into one. He has all of those leadership kind of titles. And he's generally the one that's credited with having Jesus arrested, right? Trying him falsely, condemning him wrongfully, and then turning him over to the Romans to be crucified. And yet, in the book of John, Caiaphas is hardly even mentioned. In fact, if we want to know too much about Caiaphas, we actually have to go to the other Gospels. He's almost completely absent from the book of John. So the question is, why is that? Why don't we hear much about Caiaphas from John? Okay, well, the reason is, and I kind of led you into that a little bit last week when we talked about Annas. Okay, Caiaphas is kind of like a puppet. The guy who is actually in charge of everything is the high priest formerly, who was kind of deposed or discharged by the Romans, and the Romans put Caiaphas in charge. But nonetheless, Annas is the guy. Okay, and he literally is, and we talked about that a little bit, too, sort of like a mob boss. Okay, he's taken over the temple business, and it's become his family business. And part of that is almost like racketeering. Okay, they're extorting money from all those that come to worship God, which is why Jesus has a huge problem with it. Jesus gets himself in big trouble with Annas because he's flipping over the money changers' tables and he's driving out those that are selling animals. And that hits Annas right where he lives and breathes, in his pocketbook. Jesus messed with the family business, and so Annas is the one that really has him arrested. Annas, in fact, last week he said the first one that Jesus goes to see after he's arrested is Annas. Annas wants to make sure that Jesus knows that he messed with the wrong guy, and so he goes to see Annas first. So let's pick up right where we left off last time. The last verse that we read was in John 18, verse 24. So if somebody could read that for me again, we'll move on from there. Actually, we're one. There we go. Thank you. Jump in there, don't be afraid.
It's okay. Yeah.
Then Annas bound Jesus and sent him to
Caiaphas. Beautiful. Okay, so guys, that's where we left off last time, right? Annas gets done with him, and he sends him to Caiaphas. Right? Well, it's interesting because the next time, there's a little bit of space in here, which is why we're jumping, where it talks about Peter, which we did a little while ago on what's going on out in the courtyard. But it says, then Annas sends him next to Caiaphas. And the next time we read about Caiaphas is actually in verse 28. So let's skip down to John 18, verse 28.
Jesus' trial before Caiaphas ended in the early hours of the morning. Then he was taken to the headquarters of the Roman governor. His accusers didn't go inside because it would defile them, and they wouldn't be allowed to celebrate the Passover.
Okay, so a couple of things happen here. First of all, the only thing we're told is he goes to Caiaphas, and there's a trial going on, and then Caiaphas sends him to Pilate. That's all we hear about Caiaphas. If you want to know more about what actually happened there, you have to read some of the other Gospels. And I'm not going to take you through all of those. I'll leave that to you. Okay. Instead, we're going to kind of focus on this thing going on between Annas and Pilate, because I'm going to suggest to you that what's going on between those two is as important as what's going on with Jesus, and it helps kind of explain some of the dialogue that doesn't tend to make sense without it, okay? And so, I'm going to give you a little bit of that background so it actually makes sense, because these two guys, Annas and Pilate, have a little bit of history going on, and they got to the point where they really don't like each other at all, okay? And it goes all the way back to 4 years before, Okay, so Pilate's only been around for a short time. Okay, about 4 years before the crucifixion, Pilate is commissioned as governor of Judea for the Romans. All right, and he makes a really, really bad impression the very first day, and he was handpicked for his attributes. You see, Judea was one of the most difficult of all the Roman provinces to govern. The Jews had always been rebellious. There were some places in Rome where they didn't even station Roman soldiers because they were easy to get along with. And as long as they paid their taxes, Rome was kind of cool with that. But Judea was different. They were always on the edge of rebellion, and they'd rebelled several times. And so there was never a time in Judea where there wasn't at least half a legion of Roman soldiers, which is around 3,000 guys were under Pilate's control. And so they got Roman soldiers stationed here, okay? And the governor was in charge of that. Now, one of the things that required, if you're going to rule a rebellious people, is number one, you got to be firm, okay? It's like having a rebellious child. You cannot let them get away with anything, okay? Number one. But number two is, with the Jews particularly, you needed to be wise in exactly how you did that firm response, okay? And Pilate has a reputation for those things, which is why he is appointed. The one problem that Pilate has that gets him in all kinds of trouble is, number one, he was extremely arrogant, and number two, he had no respect for the Jews or for their religion, okay? So he's a smart guy, and a firm guy, and usually a fair guy, but he has, in this particular case, he has no respect for the people that he's governing, which causes some problems, okay? Now, just kind of give you an idea, because this is one of the very first things we get into a problem is, I wanted to show you something, because the governor of, let's back that back up a bit, the governor, okay, and we hear about him in Jerusalem, and he's in there sometimes, but for the most part, he lives up here in a place called Caesarea, okay? Actually, there's a couple of Caesarea. Caesarea means a Roman city, okay? City of Caesar. And there were a couple of those. Caesarea Philippi, which Jesus goes there sometimes as well, but Caesarea, this is called Caesarea by the Sea, Maritima. Caesarea Maritima. So you with me so far? And so, literally, this is a place where the Romans made themselves at home. And what they did is, they made a city that was as much like Rome as they possibly could. Okay, so flip to the next slide here real quickly. And so this is what Caesarea looked like, Caesarea Maritima, the Caesarea, the Caesar city by the sea, looked like. And it has all of the typical Roman things that you wouldn't see in a Jewish city. Rome was about entertainment. And so they have a little theater over here, right? They have a hippodrome where they did the horse racing and all that kind of stuff. They have up here, it's kind of like almost like a small coliseum where they had the fights, and everything was about entertaining, okay? They actually have, this is a temple for some of the Roman gods, all right? And obviously this is a port. It's blocked, gated off so that their ships could come in here and be out of the weather, okay? But they literally make this thing a lot like Rome so that their soldiers that are stationed there can feel at home, because it's hard to be away from home. And so here we have this little Roman city in Israel. Okay, flip to the next slide to show you some of these. So this is, they're reconstructing this right now. When we were there, it's really kind of cool though, because this is that theater we talked about before, big theater, and this would be a stage up here, and it's like a natural amphitheater. The Romans were really, really good at the construction and stuff that they did. Now go to the next one. Here's what's left of that hippodrome. Like I said, they did the horse racing thing, and underneath here are some stables and stuff. Very cool, okay? Here is something I want to point out. Actually, we're going to talk about that as well. It's an aqueduct, okay? This is the way that they brought in water to the city. And actually, they brought it all the way from Mount Carmel, which is like 20 miles north of where Caesarea is, okay? And in fact, that's how they got water around. There's aqueducts in Jerusalem, aqueducts all over the place. This is actually still what's left of it. It would have gone like 20 miles up north from Mount Carmel all the way to Caesarea so that they could have enough water. And go to the next one. These are kind of interesting. So also, Caesarea, as you might imagine, had lots of statues of Romans, the emperors. Okay? And you know something interesting about this one, though? It's missing. Okay, go to the next one. Okay, here's another one, right? These would have been all Roman statues, and this one also has been missing. Okay, so what happened is, of course, these are the emperors were like Roman gods, and so when actually the Muslims take over the city, the first thing that they do to the Roman gods is they behead all of them. Okay, so the statues that are left, none of them have heads on them. Okay, now this is kind of important as we go forward here just a little bit. So go back to the map, Andy, at the very first. Okay, so Caesarea is up here, and that's where Pilate is most of the time. Okay, but there are times where he actually marches the troops in, and he is actually in Jerusalem. And usually those are the times where it's the most likely that there's going to be some kind of rebellion. Okay, he hates being around the Jews. Like I said, he has no respect for them. And so he doesn't spend any more time in Jerusalem than he needs to. Okay, and when he goes there, he's taken over Herod's old palace. The finest place in the city becomes Pilate's home where he is in Jerusalem. It's big. We talked about that a little bit before. Big place, big courtyard, the whole nine yards. Okay, and one of the things that was important for him is he needed some place where he felt at home. Okay. Now, one of the times where he goes there, of course, is Passover. Passover is a time where the Jews believed the Messiah was going to come. Tensions were always very, very high at Passover. With me so far? Because there was this idea that when the Messiah came, they would throw out the Romans. And so, of course, anytime there was Passover, the 3,000 guys that were up in Caesarea were in Jerusalem. Okay, and they actually have a little fort that they built there. They built it tall enough that they could overlook down into the temple so that they could keep an eye on it from their fortress. Okay, so with me so far? Okay, so kind of with that in mind, let's talk about this history that Annas and Pilate have. So the first thing that Pilate does, okay, when he becomes governor, is he comes in, he goes into Jerusalem, he takes over his place, he takes over Herod's old palace, and he wants to spruce it up a bit. He wants to redecorate it. And so he starts to bring in the statues, the Roman artwork, and some of the rest of that stuff. Well, all of that is like emperor-type stuff. And for the Romans, emperor was like a god. And for the Jews, that was like a big, huge no-no. Okay, you don't bring an image of a foreign god into the holy city, ever. And so when Pilate brings in these statues and all these things that are dedicated to the emperor at the time, the Jews have a riot. They go nuts. Okay, well, Pilate demonstrates right away from the very first, he's not going to put up with any of that stuff, and so he crushes it with brutal violence against the Jews. Okay, and moves his stuff into Herod's old palace, and he makes himself at home there. Now, one of the things about Annas is, we talked about it before, he's the godfather, okay, and he has lots and lots of money that he's gotten by fleecing the people. Okay, well, money buys you influence, and so Annas has powerful, not friends, but people he's bought off, politicians in Rome. And so Annas goes to the people that he has bribed, the people that he's paid off, and he says, your new governor is creating all kinds of problems, blah, blah, blah. And so they literally reprimand Pilate. They say, you can't do that. Get all that crap out of there, you know, and respect the Jews. And so in the end, Annas looks like a hero, and Pilate looks like a fool. Okay, and that's day one. And he's not very happy about that. And there were a couple of other little incidents, but a couple of years later, okay, another big one, okay, Pilate recognizes that their aqueduct system is inadequate, and he wants to build it bigger and better. Problem is that costs money. And he doesn't think that the Romans should have to pay for it because it really benefited the Jews as much as it benefited the Romans, okay? And so he takes money from the temple treasury. Now, the cool thing about Pilate is like, I'm not going to take the money that's set aside to help out the poor. And I'm not going to take the money that's set aside to maintain the temple or take care of the priests. But there's this extra storehouse, and it literally is Annas's money. Okay? He has this huge storehouse of money that he's got from racketeering, right? From taking advantage of the people. And so Pilate takes Annas's money to rebuild the aqueduct system. Okay? Well, how do you think Annas accepted that? He immediately goes back to his friends that he's bought off in Rome, and once again, Pilate is this time severely reprimanded for doing that, and threatened. It's like, you know what? You need to do things better or you're going to lose your job. Okay? And so, at this point, like I said, Annas and Pilate, they hate one another. And Annas has always got the best of Pilate. And so Pilate really doesn't want to do anything for Annas, but he recognizes that he likes his job and he wants to keep it. Okay, so that's a little bit of the background as these two are now going to get into a conflict over this Jewish rabbi who seems to be nothing, but ends up being like everything. Okay, so let's go back to verse 28 where we left off. Let's read that one more time since we've been away from that for a little while. Okay, so read that one more time.
Before Caiaphas ended in the early hours of the morning, then he was taken to the headquarters of the Roman governor. His accusers didn't go inside because it would defile them and they wouldn't be allowed to celebrate the Passover.
Interestingly, although they're trying to get an innocent man killed, they have a problem with some of the little things because they were afraid if they went actually into a Gentile residence, they might touch something that would render them unclean. And if they were unclean, it takes 7 days to make yourself clean again. They would miss the Passover celebration. And so they refused to even go in the courtyard. Although they're doing some of the worst stuff possible that you can do wrong, they hold on to the little things so that they look good. And I guess I could spend a ton of time on that. And hopefully none of you guys do that where it's like, you know, I just got into a huge yelling and screaming match with my wife and I put her down and I, you know, was mean to the kids and now I'm going to come to church though and I'm going to make sure that I'm good with that. You know what I'm saying? We think it's more important that you do the big things than you do the little things. It's more important that you do the important things than you do the religious things. You know what I'm talking about? It comes across as very hypocritical. And here you got these guys that literally they are wrongfully accusing Jesus. They did everything that you can imagine was against their own laws and rules to get this guy convicted. And they're taking him to the Romans to have him crucified because they don't want to do any of that stuff, especially with this. And at the same time, they're going to observe all of the finer points of the law by not even going near the Gentiles, which makes no sense at all. Anyway, let's go on to verse 29 in John 18.
So Pilate, the governor, went out to them and asked, "What is your charge against this man?"
So they bring Jesus there, but they won't go into his place. And so I'm sure it's the guards or whatever, or some of the soldiers. They go, it's like, here's this bunch of Jews out there, and they got somebody. And so Pilate has to leave his house. He needs to go outside the courtyards, and he needs to talk to the Jews. It's like, what the heck is this? What's going on? Okay. Go next to the verse 30, John 18:30.
"We wouldn't have handed him over to you if he weren't a criminal," they retorted.
And so basically the Jews go, "What do you think's going on? We're coming to you because we have somebody we need you to judge and we need you to take care of." And probably a bit sarcastic about that. He says, "We've got a criminal. We need you to judge him." Okay, next to verse 31.
"Then take him away and judge him by your own law," Pilate told them. "Only the Romans are permitted to execute someone," the Jewish leaders replied.
And so Pilate knows that they're up to something, okay? Especially at this time of year, at the Passover. It's almost unheard of that they're going to bring somebody to him to be judged on the eve of Passover. It's like, are you kidding me? you take care of your own business. Leave me out of your stuff. Right? He just wants to keep himself at a distance from the Jews, especially after getting in trouble with them a couple of times. Let's go next to verse 32.
This fulfilled Jesus' prediction about the way he would die.
And so, but Jesus knows that he has to go to the Romans, right? Because the Jews would have executed him by stoning, right? They would have stoned him to death. That was what their prescribed method of execution was. And the Romans were the only ones that really crucified people. Okay, and just so you know, this stuff going on wasn't like God's coming up with stuff on the fly or Jesus not having any idea what was going to happen to him. Let's actually look at Matthew chapter 20. Jesus had begun to predict a while ago to his disciples exactly what was going to happen to him when they went into Jerusalem this final time. Do you remember that? Okay, well, let's read it. And I think this is on a couple of slides, so you got to keep going. But it begins in verse 18. Go ahead.
Listen, he said, we're going to Jerusalem where the Son of Man will be betrayed to the leading priests and the teachers of religious law. They will sentence him to die. Then they will hand him over to the Romans to be mocked, flogged with a whip, and crucified. But on the third day, he will be raised from the dead.
So, it had been prophesied, and Jesus is going to fulfill what God had planned before there was even time. Okay, this isn't a surprise, and Jesus knows exactly how it's going to go down. In fact, he's already told his disciples, this is what's going to happen, guys, just so you know. And so be prepared for it, although they really didn't quite understand it exactly at the time. They're getting an idea, okay? Now, when the Jews did their trial of Jesus, anybody know what they convicted him of? It was a religious crime. Right, he was blasphemy. He was calling himself the Son of God, and literally saying he was God. And that's to them, that's blasphemy. Okay, but they know if they bring that charge to Pilate, he's going to say, I have nothing to do with your religious stuff. Right, you bring me criminals that are criminals against Rome, and I'll deal with those. But if this is a Jewish criminal that's done something against the Jews, you would take care of it. And so, when they bring him to Pilate, they change the charge. Right? They make it something else. So let's go ahead and read that in Luke. And there's actually two different verses. And they're separated by a couple in between. So we'll read Luke 23:2 and then 23:5. And so whoever's reading, we're going to read two slides in a row again, okay? So, let's pick it up in Luke.
They began to state their case. This man has been leading our people astray by telling them not to pay their taxes to the Roman government, and by claiming he is the Messiah, a king. Then they became insistent, but he is causing riots by his teaching wherever he goes, all over Judea from Galilee to Jerusalem.
And so, what they tell the Roman governor, Pilate, is this guy is trying to incite a riot. He's calling himself the king, and he's telling people to stop paying their taxes and start to rebel against Rome. Okay, well, rebellion against Rome, that was indeed punishable by death. This is the serious crime, and Pilate is a firm hand, and so they bring him to Pilate, and they change the charge. In fact, they charge him with something he never did, because they want him dead. Okay? But Pilate knows that something's up. Like I said, it would be really unheard of. I mean, the Jews hate the Romans, okay? They would have never brought a rebel to Pilate and said, this guy is a threat to Rome. We want you to deal with him. That just doesn't make any sense on any level. And Pilate recognizes it. He goes, look, these guys are up to something, right? So now he's a little bit cautious, all right? Let's go ahead and read now verse 34 in John 18.
Is this your own question, or did others tell you about me?
So Pilate asks him, are you a king? Are the things that they talk about you, are they true? To which Jesus replies, do I look like a threat against Rome? Or is this something that other people have told you? I mean, you've been around here for 4 years. When's the last time you saw me incite anybody to do anything? Now, Okay, so I'm just going to take a quick pause and kind of do an aside here real quickly. All right. You'll see Jesus very, very often he asks questions. They ask him a question, instead he answers with a question. It's one of those typical things that Jesus does. There's a couple of different reasons for that. But let me just tell you this, guys. Whenever you're in a situation where you're going back and forth with someone, whoever asks the questions leads the conversation. You know what I'm saying? We sometimes feel like, as Christians, that we need to be on the defensive. We need to be prepared to answer all the questions. All right. If you want to turn the tables on anybody who is attacking you by questioning you, what you respond with is a question. Whoever asks the questions leads the discussion. Are you with me? So often we feel like we have to come up with all of these, and one of the easiest questions to ask is, what do you want to know? What do you think? You know what I'm saying? Where you have people that will come against you, it's like, well, you know, what about this, that, you know, what about the Aborigine in Australia that's never heard about Jesus? What? It's like, why do you want to know? Do you know any Aborigines in Australia? You know what I'm saying? And very often, I always, when I get into a debate like this, I'm just going to give you a heads up, and we'll probably talk about it again at some point in the future, but very often, those kinds of questions aren't really about the answer. Those kind of questions are to see if they can stop you, right? They want to lead the conversation into a dead end where you don't have any place to go, okay? And so one of the things that I very often do at the end of that conversation is, if I give you an answer, okay, that satisfies you, it seems like you really want to know about Jesus, you really want to know about being saved, if I give you the answer to the question that you're asking, will you give your life to Christ? Because you know what the answer very often is? No. Because I don't really care about the answer to that. I'm just trying to control the conversation and get you to a place where you can't talk anymore. Okay? Anyway, just kind of remember that. And one of the things that Vince brought up last a couple of Wednesdays ago at the men's group is the why. It's a principle called the seven levels of why. Have you heard of that before? Usually if you ask why or something that leads into that, okay, you'll get to the bottom of what's really they're looking at or what's really going on within seven questions, okay? Because what you get usually at the surface is not what really the problem is, okay? The problem with somebody who wants to know what happens to the Aborigine out in Australia isn't about the Aborigine out in Australia, okay? It's about something else. But they get to what that problem is, what that that real issue is. You need to go a little bit deeper. And that requires that you ask some questions. Okay? Otherwise, if you try to answer it, they'll just come up with another question. That's why we need to sometimes take control. And Jesus was a master at that. They would ask him a question, and try to either get him to lead him into some saying something or whatever, and he would answer back with a question. Because that's how you take control of the conversation. Are you guys understand what that is? So this is just a little aside, kind of a tidbit for you. Okay. Onward. Let's go back to John 18, now verse 35.
Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you over to me. What have you done?"
And so Pilate says, "Just so you know, I didn't send for you. Your own people brought you here. They want something to happen. So what is it that you're doing that causes them to bring you to me?" Okay? Let's do verse 36 next.
Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not an earthly kingdom. If it were, my followers would fight to keep me from being handed over to the Jewish leaders. But my kingdom is not of this world."
And so Jesus answers him this time, honestly. He says, "I am a king, but not the way that you're thinking about it. In fact, my kingdom is not even of this world. If it was, you would have seen fighting in the streets by now with my followers. But that's not what it's all about." Okay, next to verse 37.
Pilate said, "So you are a king." Jesus responded, "You say I am a king. Actually, I was born and came into the world to testify to the truth. All who love the truth recognize that what I say is true."
And so, Pilate says, "You admit you're a king." And Jesus says, "In a certain sense, yes." Okay? But since my kingdom is not of this world, just so you know, I didn't come in to rule by war and violence and control and any of the rest of those stuff. In fact, my purpose in coming here as a king is something else. And that purpose is to help make sure that people understand what the truth is. Okay? And so next, Pilate asks probably the most important question that he could possibly ask Jesus. Okay? And let's read that next in verse 38.
What is truth? Pilate asked. Then he went out again to the people and told them, he is not guilty of any crime.
So he asks the number one big question. What is truth? But he doesn't hang around long enough to get the answer. Pilate, here's enough. He knows that Jesus is no threat to the Romans. And so he wants no part of whatever the Jews have going on. And he goes out and he says, just so you know, I've rendered a decision. This guy's not guilty of anything. I don't want to hear any more about it. So they kind of conclude this. And next week, just so you know, we'll kind of pick it up with more because the Jews aren't satisfied with Pilate letting him go. And so Pilate's going to do a bunch of other things to kind of compromise and see if he can appease them without actually doing what they want. Okay? But let's stick for a moment just on that question. Okay? That question, what is truth? Because we, guys, these days we live in a culture, in a time where nobody wants to accept the fact that there are some absolute truths. We live in the whatever era. You know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. It's like, you can believe whatever you want. As long as what you believe doesn't affect me, you don't try to push it on me, I'm perfectly cool with that. Okay? Believe whatever you want. Do whatever you want. Whatever's good for you, do it. As long as it doesn't affect me, I'm not bothered by it. Right? And seek whatever brings you pleasure. As long as you don't hurt anyone else in the process. And part of that whatever culture is, no matter what, do not do anything that's going to cast judgment on anyone else, right? It's whatever they can do whatever they want, you can do whatever you want, and just leave it like that. Everything is okay, all right? And we're considered narrow-minded and intolerant if we handle things any differently. Okay, but the truth is, guys, that there are indeed some absolute truths. Okay, and it doesn't matter how you feel about something that's true. That's not what makes it true. Okay, and it doesn't matter what you want something to be. That's not what makes it true either. And it doesn't matter what the majority believe is true. That's not what makes something true either. But there are some things that are unchanging no matter what. Okay? Now, what are the truths that bring up the most conflict? Well, if you take a stand on what is true about morality and religion, that's the quickest way for you to get into an argument with a lot of people, right? And invoke some criticism. So let me ask you, if you want to avoid conflict, the easiest thing is just to kind of go along with whatever, right? Go along with the whatever philosophy. Why is it so important that we understand what the absolute truth is? And that we hold our ground when it comes to that? Especially in the areas of morality and religion. And the answer, of course, is because there are some places where there are consequences for not knowing the truth and not doing what is right. For example, you could say, well, I got this thing of medication, right? And it says I'm supposed to take 3 tablets or whatever, blah, 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 twice a day, but I feel like taking more. Can't hurt me, right? It's good stuff. If 3 is good, then 10 should be way better. correct?
No.
But that's not always the case. If I take the wrong dose of my medication, I can't actually die from that, right? And what happens if I get on the wrong plane at the airport? Not that they let you do that, by the way, but if I were to say, like, all these planes seem to be the same, I'm sure they're all going to the same place. I'm just going to hop on this one. You quickly find out that they're not all going to the same place. You may not end up where you want to go. So I want to finish this off with John 14:6, guys. Because it relates to Jesus once again talking about what is the truth.
Jesus told him, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one can come to the Father except through me."
This is the truth that Jesus ultimately brought. It's the one that he talks to Pilate about. I came that people might know the truth. And the truth is, there's only one God, and there's only one way to God. You can't get on any plane that you want to and end up in the same place, even as much as you want that to be the case. And the fact is, the truth matters, especially if there are people that are believing the lie. It's so easy to go along with the whatever. Yeah, whatever. You know, I'm sure all roads lead to heaven. We're all worshiping the same God, right? But guys, just so you know, eternity is a very long time to be wrong. You know what I'm saying? And so I'm just going to conclude by just saying, Pilate would have done really, really well to spend a little bit more time talking to Jesus about the truth. But at this point, he's ready to move on. So, with that being said, okay, so let's pass out communion. And we're a little bit over for a variety of reasons, but that's okay. I'm going to go a little bit quicker with this. So if we can pass those out, we are going to do what Scripture commands. We're going to spend a little bit of time, guys, reflecting on what it means to take the body and the blood of Christ and what this is supposed to be about. Because it's literally supposed to be a time where we remember Jesus and what he did. It's not just something that we do. It has significance, and so we're going to reflect on that for just a couple minutes, okay? And then we'll take it together.